Let's roll.
All right. We're having a lot of technical difficulties here speaking educationally, but we are back again. Different intro music tonight. It's a long story. It's not really worth the time, but we wanted to continue rolling on. So what do you guys, we thought we would bring tonight, what do you miss the most over the past few months beyond people? I don't know who wants to go first. I'll throw it out because mine's quick. I miss reading. I have not read as much as I did in the past. And I miss it. And I really don't have an excuse other than I feel like I always need to be somewhere or see something, or I don't want to miss anything. So unfortunately, reading has taken a back seat. Who's up?
I'll go. I just got to piggyback off you. I really miss, you know, reading for fun, just for my own personal knowledge and to grow myself. And it doesn't have to anything deal with no any reading dealing tied to education, my job, career, but just something to rock and like where it feels like fun and I'm relaxing and actually turned down. That's what I miss.
You miss that calmness because you're always kind of anxious right now, right?
Yes. It seems like it's always anxious and then from one endeavor or task to another and just trying to make sure all I's are dotted and all T's are crossed, but it's all revolving around my career and I just need that take it down time.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Dina? What you got? What do you miss?
So we've discussed before in the show how I am introverted, but I'm one of these introverts that likes to be where people are, but not necessarily engage with people. So I miss just these, like, you know, well, I'm just going to go to a store and just kind of wander, you know, like I miss those, like those days where you don't have a schedule and you don't have to be at a certain place at a specific time. So it's just, you know, well, I'll just take my time in this store and I'll kind of look around and, you know, maybe I'll get some coffee. I miss that like sense of just leisurely wandering. Hmm. And I think I need to replace it with a leisurely wandering outdoors, but I just kind of miss that. And, you know, taking those day trips that you hadn't planned. And, you know, I miss the spontaneity of, you know, what my life used to be.
Interesting. I bet you missed airports, don't you? Just sitting in an airport. I always get to an airport early. You made me think about something because I enjoy that too. Just sitting there and watching people for like an hour before you get on your plane.
Yeah, I'm a big people watcher. And I'm one of those types of people that like to look at people and wonder what their life story is. And so I find people fascinating, and, you know, so I kind of miss those things and, you know, just miss those little trips and sitting in a cafe and being able to like have a cup of coffee and, yeah, you know, just that kind of thing. I miss the coffee EDUs where we met up at places.
Yes.
I miss that a lot.
I do. I really do. Like I was really enjoying Saturday mornings for like if I had one Saturday morning where I was doing that, and then the next Saturday morning, if my son had a soccer game and I could have my little chair out there with my coffee next to me and, you know, talking with another parent, like, cause you know, us dads, we just at U Sporting events, we just conjugate and then you just meet different people.
Yeah. That is true. I miss that a lot. That's cool. I saw a real quick side story because I just thought about it. On Sunday, I was driving back from the beach, and I didn't realize it, but H2O was some sort of car thing that happened in Ocean City, Maryland on Saturday night. So on the drive back from the beach, I was talking to you guys for a minute, but I probably saw 1,000 at least real tuned up Japanese, German, a couple of American, like, you know, like the small sports cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Like a bunch of 20-year-olds. It was just an interesting drive back because they were screaming by me at like 100 miles an hour blasting. I was like, this is awesome. I was like, car show.
That's why all them souped up cars was like flying south on Route 1 when I was on my way home from work on Friday.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they spray painted every single Trump sign in Sussex. Every single
Is that okay? Mm-hmm. I noticed that on the way down to work this morning, and I noticed that it had taken place, but I didn't kind of know where it came.
They arrested like 120 people. They shut secrets down. Oak put out a public message and said, if you have kids, I would take them indoors. Cause it was an impromptu meetup of just a bunch of 20 something year old kids with clearly too much money. Cause they spent so much money on their cars, just acting a fool. And they had like 120 arrests and like impounded like 12 cars. I mean, it was crazy. Driving home was nuts. It was really like, it was cool, but I didn't know what it was from, but there was like 1,000 cars speeding by me at a million miles an hour.
Yeah, John Lewis wouldn't call those arrests getting into good trouble.
He would not call that good trouble.
No, we're partying tonight. That's funny. All right, so we have a couple of topics tonight. I don't know, which one do you guys want to touch on first? Any thoughts or opinions out there, or just kind of go into it?
Just jump right in.
All right. Well, here's what I'm thinking. So the last thing that we talked about in our pregame was deficit mindset. So you guys okay if we start with that?
Sure. Let's do it.
And I'm going to go and give credit to the person that I heard say or talk about this first. This was Dr. Sarah Thomas, who we definitely need to get on this podcast sooner than later. But she kept on talking about this idea about deficit mindset a couple of years ago. And we would talk about it, and I didn't quite get it for a little while. And then I started to think about my own journey. And I know, Dina, you brought up something a little bit different before, but my thought was whenever we talk about people that are marginalized, a lot of times the stories that we remember, although are important, are often coming from a negative, slavery, for example, is the easiest one, right? Like that is always coming from a deficit mindset, but a lot of things happened that were better than that, right? So I'm always thinking now whenever we talk about issues that have to do with any sort of marginalized community, whether it be the LGBTQ, gender, race, trying to think about like what are the positive things that have happened? What are some things that are really beneficial so that we can celebrate those as well as make sure that we are accountable for those things that are not good. So I don't know who wants to go from there, but Dina, you were talking about it from a different perspective a little while ago.
I've seen this a lot as it relates to special education students. And for me, before I had heard the term deficit mindset, it started for me with hearing people say when they talked about their special education students, well, my students can't do that.
Right.
And my mentality was always, well, how do you know? You know, how do you know what your kids can and can't do? Before you even meet with the assignment, because my thinking was always that, you know, you can, your students probably can do it. You may need to scale up or scale down depending on who your students are. And a lot of times it's not the skill that it's attached to, but more or less other factors. You know, if a kid doesn't feel connected to what's happening in the classroom, they are less likely to be motivated to do the work. Yeah. So that like whole way of approaching things has always bothered me. And the more that I've gotten into working with special education students, and I attend a special education mastermind every Wednesday evening at 7:00. And the group that I'm in with is a mixed group of teachers.
Mastermind. I'm sorry. Can you tell us what is a mastermind, real quick?
So it's kind of like an affinity group where you have a lot of people gathered together, really based around one singular topic. My friend Amy runs the group, and Amy is actually the reason why I'm special education certified. It was something I did with her years ago. One of the things that we talk about is the fact that, you know, when you look at a special education student, you immediately want to look at what their deficits are. You want to approach it from that perspective rather than looking at the fact that, like every other human being, we all have strengths and things that we're challenged by. But the thinking always goes directly to what are they deficit? You know, what's the deficit? What are they deficient in? And And then there's this want to try and like fix it. And then you do a ton of remedialization. And there is really no data to support that remedialization even works. There's data to support acceleration works, but not remedialization. And what ends up happening is that you have these kids who are consistently put in these pullout situations where they know they're different, you know, and it's like, and they feel like they're different. And the last thing they want to do is go into a classroom where their deficits are highlighted. And so it becomes very much like, you know, a fishbowl situation. And it's unfortunate because I don't know anybody who's ever gotten better at something by somebody constantly telling them what's wrong with them.
Right. Or that they're different in a way that's negative. I mean, there is a rapper, there is a rapper, 2 Chainz. He wrote a song way back when I was a middle school principal called "I'm Different," and the kids loved it. But it was kind of catchy. It was like, "I'm different, yeah, I'm different." It was just a really cool song. But Gerard, what do you got? Anything on that? Or
yeah, I want to take a different spin, but also piggyback off Dina, what she said about like that mindset of my kids can't do this, and I want to take it to the student level, because I was, you know, recently involved in a conversation with a young person about, and I know every elementary school doesn't do it, but there are quite a bit of elementary schools that have some type of maybe student council or student government where there is a class representative. And the student I was talking to was a middle schooler. And I said, hey, and I was just giving advice about what they should like think about, like, hey, you ever thought about, you know, student council, this and that? And it was a black student, and the response was, they don't never pick black kids for that. And I'm like, what do you mean? So I'm engaging them, and already that's a deficit mindset. And what makes me think about the deficit mindset piece, as Dina was talking, was, okay, I'm talking to an eighth grade black student. So that means they went through, and their elementary had a form of a student council. So that means they said they went up for it a couple of times. And by the time they were in fourth, fifth grade, it was like, okay, I ain't going for it no more. So basically the system has created a deficit mindset. So here you are, you're going to have black and brown students and students of color sitting in elementary classrooms. So let's say they're zealous about trying to represent first, second, third grade. And they see that all the students that get picked throughout the whole school, there's no representation of color on there. So after about several years of that, they're going to say, this is just how things are. So they're already a deficit mindset. And how that carries through life is when they get to middle school, those same black students and students of color that saw that in elementary aren't even going to attempt to get on any type of student government activities. So then we have no representation in middle school or very small. Then that duplicates itself at the high school level. But what's really detrimental is those same black students could be great, you know, great academically, but they never really got involved with anything dealing with advocacy, activism, because they weren't involved in those, you know, class or leadership positions in school. So then those same students, if they don't go to an HBCU, they're walking into a predominantly white institution where, let's look at all these black students and students of color that went through K through 12 without having that opportunity, because after about third or fourth grade, they're already with a deficit mindset of this system is not going to pick us. So now they're on a predominantly white campus and they're not going for any of these type of student government roles or positions or advocacy or activism. And that deficit mindset is just following them throughout their whole educational career, which minimizes the voices, diverse voices on K through 12 campuses and college campuses.
Mm. I'll just throw this out there. And this was at a conference, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And I wish I could give the guy credit who said it. But, and this is to your point, Gerard, he said it, and he had some data to support this. If a kid hasn't been recognized by third grade, their idea of being recognized for doing something special beyond that, like, diminishes by like some metric standardized approach number that I don't really understand. But it just made me think about the idea that I don't necessarily agree with giving everybody a trophy,
Right.
But I think at certain levels, everybody needs to be recognized for something that's important about them, right? It may not have to be a competition. It may just be being who you are. So that's always something I try to implement in my school is like, we give out awards just because you're awesome. Like, what is it that's awesome about you? Because everybody has something awesome about them. It doesn't have to be a competition. It could just be the fact that, you know, every day you walk in with a huge smile on your face. Like, that is what brings joy to my classroom is your smile. So,
well, and it just, as you were talking, Gerard, it got me thinking about two things. One thing is that, you know, women have classically been left out of male dominated professions. And so there's this huge push now to get girls in STEM, you know, any STEM related career, because women have classically been left out of those things. And it's even to the point now where if you are a female and if there is an intersection, you could be a Black female and basically have your college education paid for, because that's your field of choice. But if you're not exposed to any of that, how are you even supposed to understand that these things are available to you? You know, so it was that. And then the other thing I got to thinking about was, Doug, with what you were talking about, like I had no idea in the earlier part of my career that I was even a good teacher. And I think we've talked about this before, but it didn't really occur to me until about 2 years ago that I'm actually really good at what I do. Not saying I don't have room for growth, but I'm actually a good teacher. And it took me a long time to be able to be okay with saying that out loud. And a lot of it is because I was never really told what I was doing that worked well. You know, there was never a conversation, even to some degree in my DPAS evaluations, there was never really a conversation about what I did. I was just told, you do this thing well. But I never understood what it was that I did. And so if you don't even have people point out to you what you're doing well, you know, it's like, how are you supposed to articulate that? And that shows up in every facet of your life. If I go to a job interview, I can't even say in a job interview what I do well because I don't know what it is.
That's interesting. That's a really interesting thought. I hadn't, because I guess, I mean, that comes full circle back to the deficit mindset, which it sounds like in order to break out of a deficit mindset, we need to have a more affirmative mindset. Like, what would be the opposite word? Because I do think affirmations are important. For a long time, and this is just Doug Tim speaking, and if you know me a little bit, you know I can't stand it when someone's like, Doug, you know, great job with it. I'm like, stop saying good job. Like, I don't want to hear it. Like, I'm the opposite. But I've also realized that as I go through my career, like, I really actually do enjoy it. I just kind of like push it away. I don't even know why. Like, I should just be more thankful and say, thank you. Thank you. You're welcome. And that's always been hard for me. And I think that's, maybe it's our profession too, a little bit, because we want to do it out of, you know, when they say passion and love versus, you know, making a salary or making it a job. It's more a career. It's something that you fall in love with, hopefully at some point while you're doing it and you want to continue to do it. But I don't know. It's interesting, the deficit mindset. So what else do you guys have on that? Anything?
It's, you know, I had a student two things. I had a student a couple of years ago that I think it was the custodian who used to clean my classroom when I was at another school was commenting about, because I did a project with the students at the beginning of the year where they did this whole collage and I would hang them up in my room because I really did want the students to feel like the room was theirs. Yeah. So I would hang those up and it was a lot of fun for the parents to come through during open house and see their kids work on the walls. And so my custodian was kind of looking at him and she goes, oh, wow, this kid has really pretty eyes. And I was like, oh, you know, well, I'll tell him you said that because I think he'll appreciate that. And when I said to him, you know, Miss C thinks you've got really pretty eyes, he looked me dead in the eyes and he goes, oh, thank you so much. And I thought to myself, I need to take compliments like that kid.
Yeah, right.
Like, I need to really take compliments like that kid. And the other thing I do is I overly apologize. And yes. I know it's not just me, but what I've started to do, and I've seen this posted in several places, and I think it's one of these things where it's like, when you need to take it on yourself, it just manifests in places so that you start to do the thing. And I, one of the things that I see is instead of apologizing for being late, start saying thank you for being so patient, you know? So it's like, you know, it's it, because I think, and sometimes too, I think the apology becomes it because it makes you feel better, but not necessarily, it's not corrective, and it certainly doesn't in all cases make things better. So I've switched it to thank you for your patience. And I practice doing this a lot with my students when I am playing around the technology and something's not going well. So the first day I did breakout rooms with Zoom wasn't my shining moment as an educator. I tell the kids, I'm like, this could go really well or it could go horribly wrong. We'll see what happens. And, you know, when I'm fiddling around with the technology and I can't get something right, I just say to the kids, I really just am so thankful for your patience right now. And the kids are always great. And I think it's practicing with them has given me more ability to be able to do it with my peers, which is a much more difficult audience to be around.
Yeah. Especially, there's nothing more uncomfortable than an awkward silence in Zoom with your, with adults. Yeah. I'll just say adults, whether it be people that you know well or people you don't know well, it's probably the most awkward thing.
It is.
For me, anyway, I don't know about you guys, but I don't know. That was good. That was a lot of good thoughts there, I think.
It is.
Wow. Gerard, do you want anything else about deficit mindset or anything before we move on to one of these other things? That-
no, I think that was great.
I agree. So what are you guys thinking about next? Accountability, best practices. My best practices thing is just a real quick, but we can certainly talk about it. And then how are we managing pacing in remote learning? Because it's definitely different. And my fear with the hybrid model, with and there's no way around it one way or the other, is that there's going to be a gap. But we'll see. You know, we try to make all sorts of predictions during COVID, and who knows if any of them are true. So what are you guys going to go with next?
Which one is really near and dear to you right now?
I'll do this one because I think this will spark some conversation. I'm going to go with best practices during COVID, right? Best practices, at least for me, has always been one of those terms like, we got to get everyone to get bought in. Like, I'm like, what does it mean? Like, what does best practices mean? Best practices for who?
It's like a word rigger.
It's like rigger. It's like research-based when the only people doing the research are the people selling you the product. I'm like, it's research-based that you paid for. Like, that's not real research. I mean, let's be real, right? So best practices during COVID, I've heard this term multiple times now, and it kind of makes me insane because who's ever done remote learning during a pandemic before? Right. Like, has it happened? Right. We've had pandemics, but not when we had the internet. So what are you talking about best practices? I mean, we've had remote schools, right? We've had lots of online learning opportunities for kids at all levels, but there are structures and things set up and architecture that was developed from the very beginning that was the focus was remote learning. So they knew what was going on. Can you recreate that immediately overnight in a month or two? Probably not. So when you tell me as a person who was a, you know, regular face-to-face teacher, not like the lead teacher in a hybrid school for the last 10 years, that you know what best practices are now and you're writing a book, especially, then I kind of lose my stuff because I don't know what have you learned not being in a classroom more than I've learned or teachers learned in the classroom that I want to buy your book. Like, I don't, it doesn't make any sense, but that's just, but I've also heard it more, you know, locally too. And I always think it's just a regurgitation of a word that doesn't make any sense right now. Cause you can't use the word best practices during COVID in a regular public school. You just can't, like it doesn't, that word doesn't exist.
And I'm,
I think it's best practices is my point.
I'm going to go out on a limb. Best practices during COVID. If it's not coming from a homeschool parent of that has went from K through 12 homeschool, like they, if we find some moms and dads that have had multiple kids that they've homeschooled from the whole level of K through 12, and at least one parent has worked outside of the home and I'm juggling it, that's where some of my best practices would be coming from. Hey, like, because they actually have a form of action research behind what they're saying. Like y'all were just saying, like, what baseline or data or research do you have? Because nobody has taught during COVID, but homeschool parents have taught K through 12 in the house and juggled everything else like we're doing.
Very interesting. I never thought about it that way. You're right. We should go recruit those parents. You're absolutely right, though. 100%. 100%. Dean, you got anything for best practices? I mean, I think we're developing them. I think there are some things that are proving to be really good practices, but
it's, I think that, and I'm like you, Doug, I'm so reluctant to label anything we're doing right now as a best practice for remote learning, because even given the fact that there's been some sort of online learning taking place for, I mean, quite some time, you know, not as long as traditional school, but people have been using an online platform to take classes for quite some time, and people are earning degrees online. But there still isn't significant research and data around it. And so I'm always reluctant to label something as a best practice without having that there. But having also said that too, there are a lot of things that are translating well, but I feel that the thing that translates the best is, one, making connections with students, because that seems to be something that I am trying to foster as much in the classroom as outside. And I'm hearing a lot of great things from my students. I do a check-in every Friday, and the students are commenting about what they see happening. And that's one of the things that they have replied back with, that, you know, that their teachers are trying to connect with them, and they're doing the best they can to engage both the students who are in the remote situation as well as the students who are in the classroom. So that seems to be a big piece of it. But it is definitely different. Mm-hmm. It's definitely different. And for anybody who has been significantly technologically averse, I'm helping one of the teachers down the hall from me quite a bit. And she's been doing her best. And I think that if you can recognize what, you know, where your challenges might be and make a plan for how to address them, I think that people appreciate and respect that. Mm-hmm. And the kids especially, because, you know, there are some days where I know kids look at me and they look at me messing around with things. They're like, you know, bless her heart, she's trying.
You think they're really saying that in their head?
I think they are a little bit.
Bless her heart, she's trying. That's perfect. That is so good. All right, Gerard, anything else, best practices, or do you want to move on? What do you guys want to do? I say we go to, how are we managing pacing in remote learning? Because I think this is following up with best practices, because, again, pacing in remote learning is very difficult. Forget the idea that one district could have a schedule that's similar throughout the district, but if you look at pacing, generally comes from, as what we've used, Common Core, is state and nationwide. How do you address pacing when one district might be doing a different model or a different set of hours or whatever, asynchronous versus synchronous? How do you even think about pacing and managing that in remote learning? We're in week three, we're in week four, sorry. And I have a conversation today, actually, about it, or two conversations today about it. And both were very different conversations. And I'm just wondering what you guys think about pacing in this. I mean, my own thoughts, just real quick. I think it's like best practices. We just don't know. So we can put some things out there. But once we get feedback, like, the feedback loop has to be more immediate around this. Mm-hmm. It can't be like, oh, we'll fix that for next quarter or next semester, or I'll slow down next year. No, it's like, we need to change it up for like Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And Monday, I'm sorry, but we got to figure it out, because it just didn't work today what we thought was going to work. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts are.
No, my thought, because I'm going to say this real quick, because since Dina is actually in the classroom, I really want to tap into her expertise on this. Doug, I'm glad we are tackling this, because I've been involved in two conversations about this just today. And I want to say, out of everything, especially about the transition to hybrid or wherever your case may be, I think this is one of the most hot buttons with teachers. And this is one of them areas where it's like a quote unquote debrief probably needs to happen on a daily basis, and a lot of grace from the leadership, grace and support from the leadership level needs to be had here, because how much as we like to stay in the pocket with pacing guys and pacing charts, especially when they come from a set curriculum from the organization or from a department above us, pacing is one area during remote learning or virtual learning, whatever it's called in certain places, that really has to be almost a daily conversation, but it needs to be a daily conversation debrief that doesn't burn the teacher out where they feel as though they're reinventing the wheel every day.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I've had conversations about day planning than I ever had before. Usually it was weekly planning, right? Now it's day by day, but sorry, Danica. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's, I totally feel that. And that I think is a big concern. But before I talk about kind of like what I'm doing, I think we also need to understand the difference between burnout and demoralization, because they are two significantly different things. And you can be in what we are dealing with right now, which is completely new and different for everybody, and experience demoralization and not burnout. And so that I think is a huge piece, you know, understanding that, you know, wherein lies the difference with that. And I've experienced both, but with burnout, you can easily solve burnout by changing your diet, changing your exercise, you know, trying to figure out how to change a few things with your lesson planning and how you assess students. And that can shift burnout without a problem. But if you go to your job and what you know is best for kids is consistently met with you don't know what you're talking about, or gaslighting or something like that, which I've also been in a work environment where that's been a thing, then there is no amount of any changing you do in your classroom that will fix your situation. And so, you know, there's, and I've, like I said, I've been in both situations before. So I know for me what it feels like when I'm in both. But having said that, I think the big thing for me was I had the same moment that a lot of people had, where when it was like time for me to, when I heard we were going back in hybrid, I had this huge like cathartic cry where I sobbed for probably a good 10 minutes, and I had all these fears that were connected with like, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? And I will say that my administrative staff has really done a great job with trying to make sure that we are doing everything that we can do to keep everybody safe. And they have taken a lot of burden off of the teaching staff by letting us know that, you know, if we trust you to be professionals, and if you're in a situation where you're not well, then please stay home. If you feel well enough to teach, then we'll make sure that your classroom has coverage and you can remote in. So that took some of the burden off, I feel, for me at least, because I don't feel this pull to try and have to go to work, or what's going to happen to me if I need to get coverage. So that was a huge piece of it. Once that kind of got removed, and understood what we were trying to do to adhere to CDC guidelines and all of that. Like once those safety things, you know, that low level, you have to feel safe to learn. Once those things were the concerns were removed, then I felt like I could actually focus on teaching. And so that was a key piece of it. And this goes to experience demoralization in your job. If you don't feel safe in your job, you are not going to be able to come in and give your best. And it doesn't matter what all is there. If you don't feel safe, you can't work. Same thing. If kids don't feel safe, they can't learn. So once those basic needs were met for me, the first thing I asked myself was, what if I give myself permission to try a lot of new things and understand some of them won't go well, you know, and get past these perfectionist tendencies that I tend to lead toward, what if this is going to be my year to try things out and try to be as innovative as possible with my own instruction, and, you know, and pride myself on the fact that I've tried things I've never tried before in teaching.
Yeah.
You know, what if
moonshot. You get like a moonshot every day, right?
Yeah. It's like, you know, and my thought was, what is the worst thing that's going to happen?
Nothing.
You know, I'm like, you know, are people safe? Are they feeling well? You know, are kids able to feel like they are a part of my classroom, even if I screw something up?
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you know, if I can manage to make everybody feel like my classroom is a safe space for them, even if they are remote, then the learning's going to take place. I just need to provide the right environment for that to occur. And I will tell you what, breakout rooms terrified me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I was so scared of breakout rooms, but I was scared of breakout rooms.
How many kids in your class? I'm sorry, like an average?
So I have the highest number of kids I have is 28. Okay. And in that class, I think I have 3 fully remote students. And then it's a little bit heavier on one cohort than the other. So one I have 15, the other I have 10. So it's a little lopsided in that way, but we do the best we can with it. And I think that generally speaking, the kids have been awesome. Like they've just been really, really good. And that makes a huge difference. But you know, I get on to, so I start off every class, everybody logs into Zoom. And for the kids initially in the beginning, that was very, very hard for them because they're like, well, why do I have to pull up Zoom if I'm here in the classroom? And I explained to them that we need the easiest possible way to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you can message somebody on Zoom, whereas we get horrible cell phone reception. So it's hit or miss whether a kid can text another kid to find out what they're doing or how things are going. So said so we, this gives us instantaneous communication with somebody that we're connecting with. And so everybody pulls it up and I explain to them, you don't have to have it up when I'm instructing. Like you can clamshell the lid on your computer and you don't have to have it up. But having everybody on Zoom at the same time also gives kids who are very introverted that don't want to raise their hand in class but want to ask questions, they message me on the chat. And that gives them an ability to ask questions. And then like if I need to know more, I just walk over and talk to them. So I feel like, you know, is this an ideal situation for everybody? Absolutely not. This is not ideal for everybody, but I feel like I hear a lot of people say things like, you know, well, it's really hard for me to engage the kids that are remote. And to some degree, I get that. But the question I have always had is how fully engaged were your kids from that when they were in the classroom?
Right.
True.
How about, I don't know if you want to say anything else, but you made me remind me of something. Like when you used to use that term back channel, like yeah. You always, whenever you presented or did something, especially at a conference, whenever I would like do like a workout, I would try to always have a back channel. And I don't think people understood the concept except for a few times where it went really, really well. Maybe I did a better job of setting it up, but that idea of a back channel, I think needs to come back when we come back.
Yes.
In some sort of format and time. No. I don't mean a parking lot. I mean a way to communicate with the person who is "quote unquote" running things. Without raising their hand.
I've done a triple layer fishbowl discussion with kids where I did something very similar to that, where you had like 5 kids in the fishbowl, and then they had each of those 5 kids had a backup, and so the backups were having the discussion about like, what kind of evidence can we use that this person can bring to the discussion? And so it enabled a communication to happen that would not have typically happened before that. But there needs to be a way for people to talk to each other in a way that feels safe and everybody feels that their voices are being heard and honored. And, you know, I don't think anything is to be had out of us making assumptions about why communicating in a certain way is better for a kid. And I feel like as teachers, we sometimes will look at kids talking and automatically assume that it's due to off-task things.
Right.
Whereas it's like, maybe the kid needs 1, maybe the kid needs to process. And 2, we all get off task.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I mean, look around at a professional development setting with teachers. You know, we're classic for being off task and having conversations that have nothing to do with what we are supposed to be learning about in that moment. But it's like, not every kid wants to speak out. And I need to just, as a professional, I need to respect that and find ways to engage the kids. So maybe instead of having, you know, all of the kids talking, maybe you want to do a discussion board. You know, it's maybe you want to not have this be like a full-on discussion because some kids are just not comfortable with having that conversation. And I don't know that there's anything really wrong with that. It's just different.
I know. I just wanted to piggyback off that when you, it like sparked something in me when you brought up about back channels, you and Doug, because like when I first started off on Twitter and like getting into Twitter chats, that was like one of the first things that was an aha moment when like SAT chats and other chats, when math teachers were talking about different tools that they were using and engagement, that right there was a core piece of them like having every student in the classroom having a part or role in their education, them being able to gauge somewhat of where they were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny how even, so you know how education is cyclical all the time. It always comes back around. Like technology ideas are going to come back around, you know, like the back channel, like one of the other things that like,
I know, right?
I can't really imagine what's next. Oh my gosh. Anyway.
Hashtag bring back the back channel.
Yeah,
bring back the back channel.
Bring it back. Anyway. I'm tired, y'all. It's been 41 minutes. last question. You know, skip this last question. We'll tackle the accountability and how it's played out in a more equitable space at a later time. Is that cool?
Yeah, because that's a big one. That's going to be a big one.
I think that is a huge one, and I think it needs to be its own episode. Yeah.
All right. Any last words from you two? I got my special outro, so be ready. Go ahead.
it's always great to. This is my beginning of the week PLN time. This is my Twitter chat time, hanging with Speaking Educationally. I'm just this growth, just spending this time in this space with y'all too, just propels my week.
Cool. I'll just throw in there. I mean, we had a lot of really good nuggets, I think, of information tonight packed into 41 minutes. So I appreciate you two both. And Jar and Dina, thank you. So what you got, Dina?
I think that people need to be forgiving of themselves. I think people have been very hard on themselves and with what they feel they can and can't do. And, you know, it's, we're all learning. And I say this all the time. I mean, we've never done this before. No one living has ever taught in a pandemic. And, you know, we're all doing the best that we can. And I think that, you know, just be a little bit forgiving and extend some grace to others because we all need it right now.
Yes.